God, I hate Rand Paul. Don't you hate Rand Paul? Hang on. Yeah, no, I know. It's just terrible. Oh, man. Ooh. The son of my all-time number one greatest hero ever. It's such a damned disappointment. I don't know. And you know what, Ron Paul? He's not perfect on everything. In fact, on Israel, you can find some pretty wishy-washy statements from the elder Dr. Paul on Israel, too. But then again, you can also find him speaking the plain, honest truth. And also, his bads are outweighed by 10 zillion goods, which Rand doesn't have the goods to balance out his bads at all. And, I mean, for what it's worth, this is meaningless other than its meaning. It doesn't have any real teeth in it. It's not really even anything. And it's not going to happen anyway. But it's just a way for him to, again, throw the occupied Palestinians under the bus so that he can try to suck up to the Israel lobby. Simple as that. You can't be the president of the United States unless the Israel lobby says it's okay. Now, he should know that that's not ever going to happen. Not with all the better choices that they have in front of them, since his last name is still Paul. The reason they will never trust him is the same reason so many, liberty-leaning conservatives and libertarians do trust him. His last name. But anyway, so the bill is, it's in Haaretz right now. Rand Paul has introduced a congressional bill that would cut off assistance to the Palestinian Authority so long as it seeks admission to the International Criminal Court, which is hilarious because, it's hilarious for a lot of reasons. First of all, go read Ramzi Baroud today. We're running him on antiwar.com, and he's talking about how this whole ICC thing is really just a PR stunt by Mahmoud Abbas. And in fact, if Rand Paul really did defund the Palestinian Authority completely and it collapsed, well, then what? Then they would be back on the responsibility of the Israelis who are occupying them. Baroud makes a pretty substantial case, I think, that the Palestinian Authority is much more than it's any kind of actual government of the Palestinians or even a pseudo-government in waiting or anything like that. They're basically just employees of the Israelis, preventing the Israelis from having to take full responsibility for the occupation. Paul Pillar, in the National Interest, calls them prison trustees. That's what he calls Hamas and the Palestinian Authority both. They're prison trustees. They're not the bosses of the place. They're the suck-ups who get a little bit of power. And as Baroud explains, they get a lot of money by not succeeding in creating a Palestinian state. They've risen up a whole little class of Palestinian parasites who suck off of the Israeli government and the American government by selling their own people short. Anyway, so what Rand is in effect, what he would be doing if this was a realistic thing at all, is he would be putting the Palestinians back on the full authority of the Israelis. At which point, if there is no Palestinian authority, and don't tell me, Justin, that he's just being too cute by half and this is what he really means to do, or anything like that. What he would be doing really is he'd be putting the Palestinians in the perfect position to say, all right, fine, I guess we're never getting two states. You admit that this is whatever you call it, Israel, we call it Palestine, but it's one state between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea, and therefore we're the majority now, a bare majority, and we want one man, one vote in the democratic Israeli state, which would, just make it that much more apparent what an apartheid, foreign colonialist dictatorship Israel is. Oh, only democracy in the Middle East. Yeah, except for half of the population who aren't allowed to participate in it at all. And anyway, this whole move by the Palestinians to join the ICC is part of their entire push to join the international institutions. But isn't that what we would want? I mean, isn't that what the empire would want for these, for Hamas, for the Palestinian Authority, who have a mutual government now, a coalition government now, to completely abandon terrorist tactics and to instead send their lawyers and diplomats to the United Nations to join these kind of institutions? In fact, there's a little pop-up on Haaretz right now that says, watch these two experts discuss, and Baroud mentions this too. I think it's Baroud that mentions this in his article today, that the prospect of... I read this pop-up wrong. Well, it was something else that I read that said, actually, I think it was Baroud's piece. It says, this whole ICC thing would actually only put the Palestinians, it would make Hamas more susceptible to war crimes charges than the Israelis, for whatever legal loophole reasons. It wouldn't necessarily, it would give the Palestinians, it would basically be them surrendering themselves up to the jurisdiction of the ICC, but without necessarily gaining the ability to file charges that would stick in any way against anybody else, if I explain that right. Here's what he told Fox News. Rand Paul said, hardly seems to me a good idea to give American taxpayer money. Well, he could have stopped right there. That would have been one thing. But to a country or an entity, right? Because it's not a country, is it? It's an occupied territory with a sock puppet prison trustee system as its pseudo government. He had to backtrack from calling it a country because it's not. Now, of course, American conservatives like to believe that Palestine is the country next door, when it's not. It's the conquered, occupied territory being colonized by foreign land rustlers, quite in violation of every international law that America has passed over the world since World War II, saying that, Lebensraum is... Lebensraum? Is that how you pronounce it? That's no longer a good enough justification for starting a war, and it's illegal to... move your people into occupied territory once you've occupied it under the American force system. I'm not saying that's necessarily 100% legit just because the UN says so or whatever treaty says so, but I'm just pointing out the hypocrisy in that what the Israelis are doing in the West Bank is obviously on its face criminal, but it's also illegal. Okay, but anyway, so Rand Paul says, well, we shouldn't be giving taxpayer money to a country or an entity that is now saying that an ally of ours, that their soldiers need to be investigated for war crimes. Well, geez, what about let justice be done though the heavens fall? If they're perfectly innocent, then who cares about an investigation? Has Rand never heard of any of the attacks on the people of the Gaza Strip? Did he not know that there was a war last summer and that more than 500 children were killed? That they have a doctrine, the Dalia Doctrine, named after a neighborhood in Lebanon that they razed entirely to the ground in 2006, that says what we do is we attack the entire population. We raise their entire neighborhoods to the ground. We collectively punish them and destroy their property and their lives if they're around. If they haven't already run to one or the other supposed safe zone that's also being bombed on the other side of town. Those are war crimes on their face, as Rand Paul well knows. But also, whoever said that Israel is an ally of America? Do you remember the Israelis, and sending their IDF to help America in their war in Afghanistan? Or in Iraq? Or in Libya? Or in anywhere? Now, I know America fights most of these wars. I don't know, Afghanistan. But fights most of these wars because that's what Israel wants in the first place. But that only makes America their ally. Doesn't make them ours. Anyway, Rand Paul is scum. And you know what? He's not going to get anywhere with this presidential thing. He has one in a 1 zillion chance of getting the nomination. It's all for nothing. Mitchell Prothero coming up in just a second.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I got Mitchell Prothero on the line. He's a reporter for McClatchy Newspapers. That's McClatchyDC.com. You can also read him at the Sac Bee, the Miami Herald, and what's the other one I've been looking at lately?
We got 31. Cookies. I can't keep them all straight.
If you get stuck behind a paywall, just clear your cookies and hit refresh, and you can read Mitch Prothero. There he is at McClatchy DC. Hey, welcome back
or
to the show.
Or subscribe. You could pay money.
You could do that too. Does anybody do that? I don't know. I guess somebody must. All right. Hey, are you back in Kurdistan now, or where yet?
Yeah, I'm in Erbil, Iraq.
Okay, there you go. Well, you and I are going to have to catch up on the war here pretty soon. But right now, we got to talk about massive breaking news. Paris, France, this morning, two gunmen armed with AK-47s killed.
We think three.
Three now. Well, go ahead. Take it from there. What all do we know about the attack in Paris this morning, and what all don't we know?
Okay, well, at this stage, the French Interior Ministry has come out, and we've been talking to eyewitnesses as well. Obviously, I've been covering it from Iraq. We've got a correspondent on his way from Berlin to Paris who will end up giving us some stuff, I think, from the ground. But I'd done a lot of reporting earlier this fall on some French jihadist stuff, so I had some contacts that I talked to. Mm-hmm. It looks like three gunmen, possibly four, but the French Interior Ministry is saying that they're looking for three suspects right now, stormed into the office of a satirical, magazine that had spent quite a lot of time, you know, making fun of just about every religious group in the world, but had also done quite a bit of stuff on Islam and the Prophet Muhammad, had run the cartoons in 2006, and had been very vocal about their refusal to bow before, you know, what had been consistent threats. They were even firebombed, I think, in 2011, and two of their editors were living on round-the-clock police protection. Guys stormed into the office. They seemed to know. It could have been a heck of a coincidence, but they were having an editorial staff meeting with everybody, all the editorial people who worked there, and killed them. Right now it's looking at 10 dead journalists, 4 in critical condition, and 2 dead cops, the cops that were actually, tasked with protecting the editors. So it was just a bloodbath, and apparently it took about 5 minutes, and the guys were able to break back out and escape in what just seems like a stunningly professional terrorist operation.
Yeah, and they just got away clean. Nobody has any idea who these guys are so far, huh?
We've just got a few hints. They were said to have spoken perfect French in the newsroom. They knew who they were looking for by name.
I heard they even went to the wrong office first and said, oh, pardon us, and turned around and left. Didn't hurt anyone there.
There's some speculation about that. I haven't confirmed that part of it yet. You know, a lot of the stuff on Twitter I get a little skeptical about until, you know, some of our French colleagues managed to really just sit down and interview people that were there. Sure. But yeah, that does seem to be that they had some kind of problem at the buzzer. They ended up basically forcing somebody at gunpoint to let them in with a key code. But they did speak French. They did say that they had avenged the Prophet Muhammad. They made clear references to jihadist literature. At some point, they did announce that they were members of Al-Qaeda. There's two disputes there. They might have said Al-Qaeda. They might have said Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, which I'm not sure at this stage is a terribly big distinction. For quite some time, we've considered AQAP to be sort of the operational wing of what you'd consider proper, you know, Zawahiri, Bin Laden, Al-Qaeda. But the intriguing thing is that on the way out, they also did kill another cop, basically, who tried to intervene, got into a quick gunfight, which I think a lot of people have seen on YouTube by now, yeah. Killed him, executed him very calmly with a shot to the head. And at that stage, we're heard speaking a Slavic language. I'm not an expert. I've had people tell me that it was Russian, which then would indicate that if, you know, they spoke perfect French, then we're speaking Russian with each other out on the street. Obviously, people start looking at the Caucasus, which have a high degree of, you know, not a high degree, but a number of jihadists, both in Al-Qaeda and ISIS, have come from Chechnya, Dagestan, and parts of those regions. So, you know, that's pretty much what we have now. But these guys are in the wind, and I think they tracked a car to the suburbs of Paris, was the last we heard, that was abandoned, and it just looks like it was a very professional operation, and the guys so far have gotten away.
All right, now, you broke this huge story that got all this attention a couple of months back about this French intelligence asset agent, exactly what you call him, I'm not sure, I'll let you call him it, who is basically a double agent. I don't know if he was all along or what, but now he's with Al-Qaeda. And I think what I'm learning for the first time here, maybe I missed it before, was that the theory is that he was behind the attack on the synagogue
back last spring.
Is that correct?
It is strongly believed by French intelligence that he was the mastermind of that operation. So, and Mohamed Merah had made references to him. That's the guy who did the attack on the synagogue. He also shot a French paratrooper who was off duty in Toulouse. And, you know, in some ways, there's some parallels to this.
And this is an al-Nusra guy now, huh? In Syria?
Keep in mind, this is where it gets complicated. I would say let's refer to them as al-Qaeda, as opposed to ISIS. These are straight guys who trained in Pakistan, Afghanistan, fought in that area, are from the tree that, you know, did 9/11, let's say, and probably on some level report to Zawahiri. Including, you know, al-Nusra refers to itself as the Syria branch of al-Qaeda. So, you know, like, to keep things simple, let's call them Qaeda guys as opposed to ISIS guys,
right,
who are, they're, you know, share an ideology but are operationally distinct.
Well, yeah, I did say, no, sir, you probably misunderstood me, because I was thinking of the attack with the start of the attacks on Syria where they said they were going after this group of al-Qaeda.
They did try to kill this guy then.
Right.
And Nusra, it does appear as though, has been sheltering guys from Afghanistan and Pakistan, including this Frenchman, David Dujon. But, you know, again, it's splitting hairs. Nusra, for the most part, has always considered itself to be the Syrian branch of al-Qaeda.
Right.
They've just said that they're not interested in doing international attacks. They just want to fight the regime. But it turned out that there was a number of guys that were trying to conduct operations under their protection from Syrian territory, and this is one of those guys. Now, whether or not this attack is going to end up being linked to those guys remains very unclear.
Sure. Yeah.
But it would make some sense that if you're talking about French-speaking guys conducting an operation for al-Qaeda, al-Qaeda has a young, up-and-coming, very aggressive and so far very competent French convert who's an operator on their behalf, who's already set off a, you know, what we believe this plot in Toulouse in 2012 that was very similar. You know, logically, it's definitely something that I'm sure French intelligence is looking into right now to see if there's a connection. It would not shock me if there was, and it wouldn't shock me if this was something independent.
Yeah. No, and you know what? I apologize, too. I was confused. I was thinking that this was the lone wolf attack at the synagogue last spring that you were referring to, but this is from 3 years ago now.
The 2012 attacks in Toulouse. You're talking about the synagogue in Belgium.
Right, right.
That was an ISIS guy that had come back, and he was really a lone wolf. Toulouse guy was believed to be a lone wolf at the time, but then it came out that he had essentially been trained in a Pakistani training camp and then sent to France to kill people and just sort of ran around Toulouse for a week shooting people.
All right. Well, we got to go, but let's see if maybe we can follow up later in the week, and then I need to talk to you about the war, too, so stay in touch.
Yeah.
All right,
okay,
thanks
great.
Very much.
Always Mitch. A pleasure, Scott.
Appreciate it.
Always a pleasure. Bye.
All right, y'all, that's the great Mitch Prothero. He's at McClatchyDC.com. Be right back.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. And I hate to change the subject on you so quick, but this is an important one. It's our good friend Will Grigg, one of the most important libertarian writers in America, right? I mean, come on. freedominourtime.blogspot.com for his great blog, Pro Libertate. freedominourtime.blogspot.com. He insists. Great article here. Will, welcome back to the show. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. Thank you so much, Scott. I appreciate your generous words.
Yeah. Well, I like you. I like reading the things that you write. I sure enjoy promoting the things that you write as much as I enjoy reading them. Brian Fisher and the Gospel of Genocide. Well, go ahead. Teach me some history.
First of all, about Brian Fisher, he used to be the chaplain for the Idaho State Senate. He's not native to Idaho, but he lived here for a number of decades and became one of the more prominent spokesmen for what's usually called the Christian right. He was quoted hundreds of times in the Idaho Statesman newspaper, which is the only significant newspaper in the only significant city in Idaho. As it happens, I have a little bit of personal history with Mr. Fisher. About 5 years ago, we took part in a debate over the supposed merits of the Iraq War, and he insisted on making this debate a discussion of the merits as he saw them, or the liabilities of the Islamic religion, which, of course, wasn't the advertised topic. I'd sort of expected him to go in that direction, but not knowing him, I didn't know the vehemence with which he would address the unworthiness of Muslims to exist, supposedly. And that somewhat surprised me. I'm happy to report that at least a few people who were in the audience who had attended his church decided to worship elsewhere after the debate. So it was a net positive, I think, for the cause of truth and freedom and toleration. He has been with the American Family Association since 2009. He went to Mississippi in that year to become the director of issues analysis for that group. That's the Reverend Don Wildman's organization. That's a name some of your listeners might remember from the culture wars of the 1980s. I most prominently remember him as putting out a perfectly demented press release in 1988 talking about the Ralph Bakshi cartoon, The New Adventures of Mighty Mouse, supposedly promoting drug use. So that's the sort of thing that obsessed him back there in the 1990s. Mr. Fisher has become sort of a one-stop shopping spot for all your demagogic needs, whether you're somebody who needs a booster shot as a Christian rightist or somebody who profits on alarming people about the Christian right. Brian Fisher will provide you with that service. He was, about 4 years ago, for some reason, he was the author of a newspaper column. He does a radio show for the AFA called Focal Point and a newspaper column and blog that discusses the same issues. He was the author of a piece that talked about the idea, very common over a century ago, that the American Indians generically, this is not by all means a monolithic group of people we're discussing, they're not homogenous, that population, but they had generically disqualified themselves to exercise what he called sovereign control over the land here in North America. And because of the fullness of their iniquity, the righteous European American settlers who arrived on the eastern seaboard and proceeded westward with a vengeance were acting on a divine mission because they had to smite and punish these people for their iniquity. And this column attracted the same kind of attention that Fisher had predicted it would, meaning most people looked at it and wondered if it had just been recently extracted from a glacier. And the AFA, which previously hadn't displayed a moral gag reflex regarding anything he had said, decided to take this column down, but not before it had been archived. And it's still available if you know where to look for it on the web. And he's gone back to the subject on several occasions over the last 4 years, most recently a couple of weeks ago on his radio program, or a couple of months ago, rather, on his radio program. And one of the objectives I had in writing this piece not only was to explain that you don't have to embrace this gospel of genocide, this eliminationist theology, in order to be a Christian, a serious Christian, or even a fundamentalist Christian. That's the first thing I wanted to disabuse people of, is that this is not in any way coterminous with Christianity, any more than some of the stuff that you see associated with ISIS is in any way an innate part of Islam. But secondly, I wanted to point out that the ideology he's promoting here was of a piece with what ended up being exported by the United States government after Frederick Jackson Turner declared the frontier closed in 1890. And post-Wounded Knee, the U.S. government began to export that kind of benevolence to places like Cuba and the Philippines and Hawaii. And it was based on the same sort of dumbed-down Rudyard Kipling white man's burden philosophy, or ideology, better stated, that we had to go abroad in search of savages to Christianize and to civilize. And one of the things I wanted to highlight as well is that there was a brief period at the founding of our country, way back in 1789, I quote Henry Knox, the first Secretary of War on this subject, where it was understood that the new United States government, the new republic called the United States of America, was engaged in foreign policy with these Indian tribes it was encountering on the vast mass of land west of that small sliver on the eastern seaboard where the colonies had taken root and created the Confederation. And Henry Knox said, wait a second, these people were here first. they're in possession of the land, and if they want to sell it to us, I'm paraphrasing, of course, if they want to sell it to us, that's fine. But we can't pretend as if we simply have the right to take it from them, because we're dealing here essentially with peers.
Yeah, we just buy from Napoleon.
Yeah, or buy from Napoleon, which is one of Jefferson's great sins that set manifest destiny into motion. One of the interesting things about Fisher, by the way, is that he name drops Lewis and Clark and says that their journals are replete with descriptions of the savage and immoral conduct of the American Indian tribes. If you've actually read Lewis and Clark's journals, and I have, not recently, I've recently reviewed some of them, apparently Fisher hasn't, one of the persistent themes in the journals is the astonishment on the part of at least some of these Indian tribes at the brutality of discipline that characterized the Corps of Discovery, and the fact that these people insisted on getting plastered as their preferred form of recreation. Some of the Mandan Indian leaders, for instance, didn't consider Lewis and Clark to be their friends because they insisted on plying them with alcohol, and they had no interest in it. Of course, that's something that would change, unfortunately. But one of the things that you adverted to there, Scott, of course, is the idea that these grand imperial designs often ended up transferring control over these vast tracts of territory here in North America that were already inhabited by people that didn't realize that they were under new management, so to speak, that they were now under the new sovereignty as opposed to imperial France. Now they're being controlled by the Americans. Or up here in the Northwest, there was a near war between the United States and Great Britain over control of lands that had been occupied by the Flatheads and by the Nez Perce and other American Indian tribes, and suddenly these people found themselves under the control of a new sovereign. And, of course, they didn't have a concept of sovereignty of that sort. Many of these American Indian tribes, particularly in the Northwest, were what we'd call agorist in outlook. Their leadership was defined by people who had better ideas in terms of conducting commerce with other Indian communities, or they had better ideas to how to exploit responsibly in most cases, not all, but in most cases, exploit the natural resources. They knew where to hunt and to fish. They knew where the camas roots were to be found. They knew how to cultivate some of these crops that gather themselves in an assembly, in an agorist style, and a leader would propose a plan of action, or somebody who wanted to be a leader would propose a plan of action, and they'd follow him until somebody came along with a better idea. So it was completely alien to these people that suddenly these people with strange habits and superior technology showed up and said, okay, well, great. There's a great father back in a town you never heard of called Washington, and he sent us as your rulers, as his emissaries, to prescribe the conditions under which you'll now be permitted to live. Now, Brian Fisher is typical of people who think that that's just the way that the world should work, because the Euro-Americans came here as the divinely commissioned agents to civilize this continent, and in doing so, of course, they committed horrible, horrible atrocities that no standard of decency would consider to be appropriate, you know, starting with many of the things that happened during the pre-colonial era. The Puritans were not necessarily on good terms with the Indians of the eastern part of the landmass, but progressing through this exercise in conquest called Manifest Destiny, which was, if you will, the original foreign policy of the United States government, which is why I consider it so significant. Right. They started out with announced intentions of conducting affairs on the basis of commerce and diplomacy and mutual benefit. And as soon as they had the power to do so, they began to exercise sovereign control in ways that resulted in the death of tens or hundreds of thousands of people through violence and disease.
All right, hold it right there. We'll be right back with the great Will Gregg. freedominourtime.blogspot.com. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast Peace Talks have gone nowhere. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Will Gregg. You know, back in history, he was the greatest writer at the New American, one of the leaders of the John Birch Society, and yet the closest terminology I can come up with to approximate what you're talking about here, it comes straight from Noam Chomsky, Will, and that's the saltwater fallacy that Americans engage in, where even anti-imperialists can't acknowledge that America's been an empire since the mm-hmm. Constitution was ratified, at least. And that somehow it's not an empire until it's Hawaiians or Filipinos or Japanese that you're killing. But, you know, tell that to the Sioux if you can find one, right? That's the whole thing. And why I think this article is really so important is, you know, it's facing up to the unface-up-toable. And I don't know. In my experience, they teach you that, yeah, the Indian Wars and all that, that was really pretty bad. And collectively, we Americans, we're sorry about that now that it's 130 years later or whatever.
Yeah.
Kind of wish that hadn't happened. But that's still at a young enough age where they don't really teach you the disgusting, you know, the real worst stuff. Not usually. And here you're making it really plain that in so many conservative mythologies, and whatever's wrong with America just started going wrong the other day when, you know, the liberals did this or that or whatever it is. This nation was founded on brutality, the likes of which Americans can't even imagine. Even Iraq War veterans maybe don't imagine some of the stuff that they did to the American Indians to take this continent.
One of the little affectations of every empire is that they always try to appropriate the valor of the overmatched societies that they conquered and absorbed, which is one of the reasons why Queen Victoria always liked to gad about in Scotland, affecting the attire of the Highland Scots who've been wiped out at Culloden in, I believe, it was 1746. And you have the emissaries of America's imperial benevolence today flying Apache helicopters and having Geronimo weapon systems and things of that sort. They recognize the valor of these overmatched people who fought with doomed courage against being assimilated into the empire that is now being promoted using, if you will, the brand names of all these conquered tribes and conquered societies. And Chomsky, of course, gets a great deal of it right, would agree about a great deal regarding history, because history is already established and settled. Now that there's a decent interval, there's a decent gap of separation between our current time and those events, people can acknowledge that these things were done. At the time, there were many courageous people, including, as I mentioned in the article, a few people in government service who actually condemned what was going on in real time. There was this 1869 Presidential Commission on the American Indians that said in so many words that the burden of American history at that point, this is just when Manifest Destiny was really starting to get nasty, but up to that point, the rule was that the American settlers and the American government were the aggressors and that the Indians were the victims. And the exception would be when the Indians would act as aggressors. And even in those situations, it was usually by way of retaliation as opposed to seeking to conquer the Euro-Americans. They really didn't entertain designs of conquest. They just retaliate in ways that would end up killing innocent people, like what happened at Fort Mims. I talk about that during the Red Sticks War, the Creek Uprising, where Andrew Jackson first distinguished himself. And Jackson, of course, is considered to be a hero not only by the conservatives but by the neocons. The Jacksonian foreign policy, we're told, dictates involvement in foreign affairs and the use of unfiltered brutality in dealing with those who resist our intentions. That's something that we had the Council on Foreign Relations talking about a decade ago. Well, Jackson, in his retaliatory raids following the Fort Mims attack, and as I point out in the article, the Fort Mims attack was brutal. There were terrible things done by the Creek warriors, but for the most part, they focused their attention on people under arms who were part of a recognizable, hostile foreign military force. And on a couple of occasions, they actually liberated some of the black people being held as slaves there at Fort Mims, which is an ironic bit of history that gave rise in the next couple of decades to these constantly reiterated sort of proto-Fox News alarmist stories about the Indians and the black slaves conducting a servile uprising, wiping out the white population there of Florida's and Alabama and Mississippi and so forth. But during the retaliatory raid conducted by Jackson, one of his lieutenants being a frontiersman from Kentucky by the name of Davy Crockett, who was disgusted by what he saw, there was an episode where they wiped out an entire village and then found that there are survivors who had taken refuge in a cabin, and they locked the cabin, they surrounded it with armed troops, and then they put it to the torch. And for the next couple of hours, of course, these people burned to death, and they were prevented from exiting by the fact that there was a military force surrounding this cabin. And I said that this is sort of an ancient, if you will, shakedown cruise for what was done at Waco in 1993. And so contemporary American conservatives, for the most part, can recognize that Waco was an atrocity, but they don't understand that what happened at Waco was really an adaptation of what had been used as a method on more than one occasion during the conquest of the continent that they celebrate as one of the defining aspects of American greatness. But once again, there were people even in government in the 1860s, and some in the military. I mentioned elsewhere, not in this article, but in the podcast I recently did, George Crook, who was considered the paramount and most accomplished Indian fighter. He actually allowed himself to be sued in, I believe it was 1879, by Chief Standing Bear of the Ponca. And the Poncas, this is something Brian Fisher wouldn't appreciate. Brian Fisher, the American Family Association, is the blathers guide who inspired my most recent article. He seems to think that none of the Indians accepted Christianity and that they were all heathens of an irredeemable sort, and so this justifies this jihad that conquered them. The Poncas were Christians for the most part. Chief Standing Bear was a Christian. His son was a Christian. When the troops showed up to dispossess them there on the banks of the Nabrar River, they had to tear down an entire village, and in doing so, they burned churches. They burned churches where these people worshipped to drive them to Oklahoma, which was sort of the 19th century equivalent of Siberia.
Yeah.
But as all this is going on, there were people across the region, Euro-American settlers, American settlers and government officials who were mortified by what happened. And when Chief Standing Bear wanted to go back to his homeland to bury the body of his teenage son, he was arrested and put on trial, and he filed a habeas corpus petition, and he was told, you can't do that because you're not an American citizen. Where have we heard that line more recently? Well, General Crook allowed himself to be sued in order to establish as a matter of law that an American Indian is a person under the 14th Amendment and as such is protected by the habeas corpus guarantee. So, you know, there were a few people of conscience that did that sort of thing. I quote Kit Carson in this piece, criticizing the Sand River Massacre and the abominable figure, John Chivington, mm-hmm. the ordained Methodist minister who wiped out a couple of hundred completely peaceful Cheyenne who were under the lead of Chief Black Kettle, who is probably the bravest man I've ever read about. There's a wonderful biography of him talking about his career as a peacemaker. And peacemakers tend to be insanely brave men, and he was probably the most distinguished in that company. But they flew an American flag over their encampment that had been given to them by the Army as a sign of good intentions. They said, this will protect you against the Army. Well, it didn't. Chivington waded in and hacked everybody to death, then returned to Denver in triumph, showing curios and artifacts that they had made from the genitalia of their victims. And he hailed himself as a great Christian Indian fighter. And Kit Carson, when he heard about it, said in so many words, this man is a rat bastard, and he doesn't deserve to be anywhere in civilized company. He said, and Kit Carson pointed out, he had fought Indians, and he wasn't proud of it particularly. He said they used to own this land, and now they've got practically nowhere to go. And he ended up becoming disgusted, and he, strangely enough, after a long career as an Indian fighter, he became a very devout Catholic and spent a lot of his time and his declining years regretting a lot of what he had done. But as you say, Scott, the westward course of American expansion was the westward course of empire. You know, ab initio, the United States government has had imperial ambitions, and they have pursued them like any other imperial power in history. Mm-hmm. And we were supposed to be exceptional. You know, our exceptionalism was supposed to be defined by the fact that people were ruled by law, and that law was essentially an elaboration on the golden rule. And this was something that was lost very quickly, because as soon as the government in Washington and its outward outposts had the ability to inflict its will, it did so pitilessly. And the only reason why the body count of 19th century American expansion westward can't really compare to the body count of the Soviet Union's imperial consolidation phase, I think, is technological. I think that if the technology had been comparable, the body count as well would have been comparable. If you take a look at it in adjusted demographic terms, there really isn't that much difference. And that's, as you say, Scott, a truth before which a lot of our pretenses melt, and that's one of the reasons why so many people, I'm thinking of you, Dinesh D'Souza, don't want to address this honestly.
Right. Well, you know, part of this, too, is, you know, like you say about the exceptionalism, where we're not exceptional because we have morality. We're exceptional, or, okay, let's pretend that that's what it is. But now that we're exceptional, that's the name on our license. That's
exactly.
That's now our permission to commit any crime, to commit any sin, and get away with it clean. And that's, I think, you know,
what we do is virtuous because we're the ones who do it.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, with any kind of tribal identification, any kind of us versus them, even if you're talking about, you know, cities, football teams versus each other, whatever it is, people love, you know, glomming on to things like that, being part of things like that. But when you add, oh no, we're the only ones who were saved by the grace of God, and we're the only ones who are going to heaven forever, and everyone else is a heathen and half a demon at best, then yeah. That's a whole new level of permission to slaughter them. And anything that Jesus ever said about not slaughtering people, notwithstanding.
Yeah, but that's, I guess, just a set of footnotes in their hortatory rather than mandatory. But one of the things that I find myself commenting upon frequently is the fact that people who profess to follow the Great Commission at the end of the book of Matthew, and Brian Fisher would be a pretty good example of such, they seem to have this indecent eagerness to send people to hell when the whole point of the Christian gospel is you're supposed to share with people how they could get to heaven, because it's not supposed to be exclusive. It's not supposed to be a club that you beat people into, which seems to be the way that Brian Fisher approaches things. He's a big proponent of torture, no surprise there. And as I said at the end of my piece, it seems to me that he wants to get on with the really satisfying business of seeing people consigned to eternal torment, and failing that, he likes to celebrate episodes in our history where hell has been anticipated or created here on Earth in the name of the triumph of the faction that he identifies with. And I don't see how that can in any way be reconciled with universalist claims of the Christian gospel, in which all these tribal considerations make no difference at all, or at least they shouldn't.
Right. Well, you know, it's kind of like George Carlin talking about he worships the sun because, hey, at least I can see the sun, man, and that kind of thing. I think that's how it is with these state worshipers. I mean, they,
exactly.
Where Christianity is, that's the imperial robe they're wearing is, oh, yeah, and it's all blessed by Jesus, et cetera. But the state, hey, that's a real thing that they can push, especially you mentioned the Christian right. I mean, what does that mean? That's a political movement. That's a movement to seize the power of the state and use it to make things their way. And
yeah.
So, you know, that's just something. It's just easier. It's more accessible for the worship. That's all.
Yeah. If you've read the Bible at all seriously, you'd recognize that that's the Babylonian concept of rule that we're supposed to be avoiding. And my belief is you're called to come out of Babylon. And that means that if you're a Christian believer, you're supposed to make the invisible love of God real and visible and tangible. And that's not something you can do at the point of a bayonet, and that's certainly not something you're doing when you're conferring a blessing, a benediction on that kind of behavior.
Yep. All right. Well, listen, I've already kept you over time. I need to let you go, but thank you so much for coming back on the show and for writing all this great stuff like you do.
Thank you so much, Scott. I really appreciate it.
I appreciate it, too. All right, y'all. That's the great Will Grigg. And listen, he's got a PayPal button at the bottom of each of these articles. He's an independent journalist here. He needs your support, and you need his work. And so, you know, when it comes to facing up to things, face up to what you owe Will for what he does. Pro Libertate, freedom in our time. .blogspot.com. This one is called Brian Fisher and the Gospel of Genocide. Right back after this. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. I'm just in the nickel of the dime. I got Gareth Porter on the show. Lined up on the line, I mean to say. Hey, Gareth, how are you doing?
I'm right here, Scott.
Very happy to have you back on the show, sir. Happy
Thanks
New Year.
Thanks for having me again, Scott. Good to be back.
So, first of all, I just have to say this. You don't have to comment if you don't want, but it's just incredible to me that the national police in Paris have not tracked down the shooters at this attack this morning yet, and they're just out there somewhere. You know, what an insane thing. They got no leads or what? It's already nighttime over there right now. Anyway.
Yes, this is a bit of a shock for sure, yes.
Yeah, something else. All right, well, so listen, I want to talk about your article. I got it here somewhere, don't I? Where's my Iraq war section? Here we go. The real politics behind the U.S. war on ISIS, which reminds me, and I had forgotten this until just this moment. We got to settle this bet, but I'm not sure how to settle it. We made a $10 bet that we'd have ground forces in Iraq by New Year's. And yet what we have are a lot of advisors and uncounted numbers of special forces and spies and mercs. And now one supporter of the show already sent me your $10 to cover your side of the bet when, when Obama announced it would, he was going up to 3,000 now.
But I don't want to be a hard ass on this, but I don't remember exactly, you know, what the terms were. Did we say combat troops or did we just say ground troops?
You know, I think we might have left that too vague in the first place
That's my impression.
Because, of course, Obama's scheme from the time he became president was to call combat troops something other than combat troops so that he can keep them in Iraq longer. We saw that from 2009 through 11 there. So
right, and that's a reasonable suspicion that that is that's going to happen.
Yeah, but I don't think we said it has to be a battalion or it has to be, you know, whatever strength. We do have guys fighting in Anbar. We got guys flying helicopters and we've got guys on the ground pulling triggers fighting the Islamic State in Anbar province, right?
Well, I actually have not seen the stories about that. The only thing that I've seen is a story, and maybe you're referring to the same thing, about special forces who were sighted coming down a mountain, in a white Toyotas or whatever it is that they always use, the special operations forces units. And, that leads to a suspicion that they're somehow, more directly involved than simply, helping to target, for the Iraqi or Kurdish forces. But so far I haven't seen anything more than that. Are you referring to something more different from that?
Yeah. And, you know, I think I may have overstated a little bit. It's the headline from 2 days ago on CNN was about American soldiers under regular fire. Oh, it's on antiwar.com still today here. Or was that from a couple days ago? U.S. troops in Iraq under fire from ISIS on regular basis. And I guess I was just, conflating it with an earlier report about them shooting back, I think. But I don't know. There was also the report, boots in the air, about the Apache helicopters flying out from the airport and hitting targets on the ground there in Anbar. But, yeah, I may have overstated CNN story.
I think we both agree that the big question mark here is whether there will be continued mission creep that does involve open, combat by U.S. troops. And, I mean, that's
And there
still
certainly are JSOC guys lasing targets for the Air Force. That was in the Daily Beast. They got German
special
forces
there. The special forces are definitely there. Yeah. They're trigger happy. They want to get into the fight. We know that, as I mentioned in my article. And whether they will do that or actually are already doing it, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, now, so let's get to the politics of the thing because, well, let me talk to you about this Patrick Coburn article. I don't know if you saw his latest, but this is basically his theme for a long time now. And that is that the Americans have really underestimated the Islamic State, or at least they act like it. They have stated these expansive goals that we're not ever going to allow Iraqi Sunnistan to be a safe haven for terrorists, which is what Obama's been saying from his very first press conference after the fall of Mosul. But then on the other hand, they got some airstrikes here and some special forces there, and it sure doesn't amount to, really sending in the Marines to sack Mosul. There's some tough talk by some Kurdish Peshmerga that they're going to go into Mosul sometime later this year, but that doesn't seem too believable to me. So and I don't think to Coburn either, doesn't seem like. So there seems to be a real gap between what they say they're doing and what's actually going to be required to remove these guys from, at least to turn them back into an insurgency from the pseudo state that they've declared themselves to be now.
Well, that's exactly the premise of my piece, which is that there is this contradiction between the stated goal of dismantling ultimately the Islamic State and the reality, which is that it can't be done with the means that have been chosen or have been actually put into operation. And that's there's a consensus about that by virtually everyone who speaks independently rather than officially on this question. And even, certainly off the record, I'm sure you've seen statements being made by people in the military, questioning whether that's going to work. So I mean, that's really the starting point for my analysis of the real politics here.
Right. Now, regular listeners to the show, they understand, but it bears repeating. You have a pretty specific point of view, and I think it's quite in common with a lot of libertarian view about the nature of bureaucracy and how it works and the role it plays, especially in American foreign policy. Really, what you say is exactly what Justin Raimondo calls his libertarian realism, which is it's all about domestic politics. And I think you may emphasize more than him the political role that the generals and the admirals themselves play and how much weight that they have in the decision making here.
Exactly. And I, you know, I see this new war on the Islamic State as a yet another case study which lines up, I think, with a whole host of previous historical cases. And I include there, of course, Vietnam as well as Afghanistan as the two primary, the clearest cases where the president was not the primary force behind the impetus for war, and indeed the president was not at all eager or was actually resisting the pressure to escalate U.S. involvement militarily and wanted to avoid the kind of a commitment, military commitment, that the national security state was pushing for very, very strongly. And, you know, my analysis of what has happened in this case is that something along those lines, although we don't have the details that we have on both the Afghanistan and Vietnam cases, it seems clear that something along those lines did in fact take place with regard to Obama's decision making on the way in which to present the what the United States was doing, as well as you know, the actual commitment of forces. So, I mean, I think it begins with the fact that that there was a you know, a key turning point here with the beheading of the two Americans held by the Islamic State. Before that, there was much more explicit, limited language attached to the U.S. Use of air power in Iraq. And after those beheadings, there was a sudden lurch in the direction of a much more expansive role militarily articulated by the White House.
Right. Not much change in the actual role, but in their statements about what it entailed. All right. Well, anyway, dang, music's playing and we're interrupted. We'll be right back, everybody, with the great Gareth Porter from IPS News right after this. Hey, you own a business? Maybe we should consider advertising on the show. See if we can make a little bit of money. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org. All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott. It's my show. I got the great Gareth Porter on the line. I neglected to mention at the top of the show that he's the author of the book Manufactured Crisis. Get it. In fact, get two and then drop one off at your local library. Manufactured Crisis: How Everything You Ever Heard About Iran's Nuclear Program Being a Threat Isn't True, by Gareth Porter. That's not the actual subtitle. That's just mine because I don't have it in front of me. All right, so we're talking about the politics behind the Iraq War and Iraq War 3 now, it is, 3.5, whatever. Gareth, and you're saying it's all domestic politics, and after the beheadings last summer, obviously the pressure was ratcheted up for, okay, now we got to start calling it a war. Although, honestly, I think Obama's first statement out in front of the helicopter on the lawn was, back in early June, was, we will not allow for there to be a safe haven for terrorists in Iraq. And that's about as expansive as a mandate as you could possibly get, bigger than Lyndon Johnson, the one he got from the Congress. And Obama just declared it for himself right there on the spot on the lawn. But I guess they did ratchet the rhetoric down a little bit after that, and then it did ratchet back up. So the question is, and I'm not trying to shame them in invading the damn place. I don't want anything to do with it, of course. But But the question is, what in the hell are they doing? They're talking real tough, but they're not really waging a war. Is that a hopeful sign that Obama just, you know, in a good way, isn't man enough to do the horrible thing they want him to do?
No, that's not very good news. But we have to do, you know, we should back up and just note that, you know, look, Obama was obviously, based on the public record that we have now, interested in terms of his own political interests, sitting there in the White House, in basically dialing down the war on terror, the global war on terrorism. I don't want to go into detail on that, but there's a lot of evidence that some evidence, but crucial evidence that he was hoping to be able to get out of to basically reduce the footprint of the United States in terms of drone strikes and special operations forces, and really begin to say, look, we're getting out of this business. It's time to come back and focus on problems at home. And so, I mean, this is part of the deal, I think, that one has to understand as far as his response to the ISIS problem. And, you know, he did underestimate them. And I think that he was motivated to underestimate them by this desire, both to claim victory, of course, in counterterrorism. I mean, that's part of the political appeal of this position, but also, you know, actually to be able to focus more on domestic politics, domestic political issues. And this is one of the ways in which the interests of the White House do, in fact, differ from the interests of the national security state. And I put a lot of emphasis on that. So, yeah. I mean, that's the starting point. And, you know, clearly, you know, he was strongly influenced by the beheadings. He did, you know, change his rhetoric after that. Even then, I make the point in my piece that on August 25th, Ben Rhodes, his young, very ambitious, deputy national security advisor, was telling reporters that, the IS is still a deeply rooted organization, and not to expect that the U.S. military forces were going to be able to evict them from the communities where they operate. Now, that was that's a very interesting bit of rhetoric, because it looks to me like they were very consciously trying to set up a firewall between the use of force there and what they believed the military at that point was interested in doing, which was getting deeper into this and justifying more types of military force. So that's essentially, I think, the analysis that I would make about the tensions between the White House and the military over this. And then it comes out more explicitly in the use of the term war, that is the White House reluctance to use the term war for this, and the Pentagon apparently saying, well, no, of course this is a war. What are you talking about? And the White House then caving in. And I think that's just an interesting little insight into the maneuvering that was taking place over the potential future of this military engagement.
Yeah. No, you're right. I mean, I got to admit that it's surprising the degree to which he's been reluctant to do this, the degree to which at least the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the rest of them were openly gaming him. It was just like in the fall of 2009 when they were saying, oh, he's dithering. We got to have a surge in Afghanistan. It's that same kind of thing where Pentagon
absolutely.
Is saying they're not satisfied with their commander in chief, like the NYPD saying, we don't like the mayor. Yeah, well, who asked you?
And the reason that I said it's not such good news that, you know, that he's simply, you know, that he would like to do less is that he has shown over and over again that he does compromise under pressure. And that is of the essence, it seems to me, historically, of the relationship between presidents and the national security state, even when the presidents are, you know, feel very strongly about the idea that the United States should not be going to war or should limit strictly the degree to which it is involved in a war. And that was certainly the case with Lyndon Johnson, as I've shown in my book on Vietnam. So I think we're, you know, faced here with this a primordial problem in the United States that the national security state has acquired such political power that that the White House is invariably intimidated by it in various ways. It feels the heat from the military when the military forces and the Secretary of Defense plus the CIA and NSA now as part of this team. And that's what I think we're facing in this case of the war against the Islamic State.
Yeah. Well, you know, so what about Libya? You think they made him do that? Because he was kind of reluctant for a little while. It was obviously the dumbest thing in the world to do.
Well, I have to be honest and say that
he came out
not,
and said Assad has to go too, and
I've not carefully evaluated or you know, investigated, I should say, the Libya case. I don't know enough to give a very good informed answer on that. I mean, my suspicion is that there was, you know, a degree of active pressure from some parts
of
the military.
Well, here's the thing, and this has to be said, Gareth, before we're completely out of time here, which is that anybody else could just, you know, could try a lot harder, that the buck stops with him. It's his responsibility. I know he's just a figurehead for Goldman Sachs and the Pentagon and Lockheed and whatever, but he's still the guy in the chair, and he's still the guy with the bully pulpit.
I agree with you. I think that it's an indication of grave personal weakness that we're looking at here, and I think that is, in some sense, the case with all the post-Eisenhower presidencies.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it'd be so simple for any of us to say, like, well, whatever, everybody's got to die sometime. I don't care what you say. It's just like Ron Paul. They would ask Ron Paul, well, what are you going to do when you become president? Your first day in office. He said, the first thing I'm going to do is call the admirals and tell them to pull their boats back away from Iran. You know, yeah, and the truth is that's exactly what he would have done. That's exactly what he would have done. And if they refused, he would have relieved them all of their command. As simple as that. And it would have been implicit that you better have a bubble top on your limo, and he would have been brave enough to go ahead and do the right thing anyway. Right?
Yeah, and that's why he was never very ambitious politically. And maybe, you know, you could also look at it exactly the other way around. You know, because he wasn't ambitious politically, he was able to take those positions.
Yeah, sure. But you know, anyway, it is disgraceful, and it's, I just don't want it to sound too much like this is some apologia for poor Obama. When you know, it came down to it, Truman fired MacArthur. He said, oh, yeah, you don't like it, you're fired. And the American people, the way I learned it anyway, they took the president's side on that, even if they didn't necessarily agree with him on the decision to not get into a nuclear war with China.
And you know, I think that episode does, in fact, illustrate the degree to which the political system, the nature of this political system, has changed so profoundly. Because I really have a hard time imagining that this would happen in any of the post Truman any of the post Eisenhower presidencies. Of course, we did have Eisenhower for those 8 years, even as the system, the national security state, was building up its power. But he was in effect, you know, holding them back to a significant degree. But since then, none of the presidents have been willing to stand up to the military over issues that really involved the fundamental interests of the national security state.
Right. All right. And with that, we got to go. We're over time here. But thank you so much for coming back on the show, as always, Gareth. I appreciate talking to you.
Thanks again, Scott.
All right, y'all. That's the great Gareth Porter. IPSnews.net, truthout.org, antiwar.com, Manufactured Crisis. Go get it on Amazon. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders, quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at DarrensCoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. DarrensCoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. DarrensCoffee.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. Yeah, I had to go into the break there with Garrett just a little bit. Full archive will be on scotthorton.org later on. Okay, so next up is Jim Babb. You hear his commercials run here all the time on the Liberty Radio Network for his project, DownsizeDC.com. Welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Great, but I'm not Jim Babka. I'm Jim Babb.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. I got you completely confused.
That's okay. He's a great guy, too.
Okay, well, cool. Jim Babka. That's him. You're Bab. Okay, gotcha.
Yes.
All right. I'm an idiot.
No.
You're Bab, he's Babka, and I'm foolish. So, good. Well, I was going to say, tell us all about this other project that has nothing to do with Downsize DC anyway. the Jury Rights Project. What's that?
It's an education campaign, and the purpose of the campaign is to inform the general public about their right to nullify bad laws. That means if you get on a jury, you have the power to say not guilty, even if the facts of the case indicate that the person might have committed the crime. So if somebody smoked a joint, you can say, I don't think that's a legitimate crime. There's no victim, so I'm going to say not guilty and send that person home to their family. So when people exercise this right, it's called jury nullification. And it's one of the sort of the final steps that the government has to go through before they can hurt somebody, is to get through that juror. So this campaign in New York City, people can find out about it at juryrightsproject.com/NYC. We've got 6 kiosk ads that surround the courthouse in southern Manhattan, and we also have a pamphleting campaign on the sidewalk to inform people about this right.
Great. Okay, so I have some questions, and I think I already know the answer to some of them, but then again, I think I might be wrong. Now, is what you're describing here, is this legal, or this is just because they can't punish a juror for the way he votes, unless it's for a corrupt, you know, bribery-type reason or something like that, in the law, and so it's sort of a loophole, or how exactly does that work? I'm trying to put myself in the position of someone who maybe they've been on a jury before, and the judge told them, if you agree with the prosecution on the facts here, then this guy's guilty, and you must find that way.
Well, it's 100% legal. It's been a tradition of the justice system for centuries, going back as far as the Magna Carta. It is an essential part of the very jury process itself. There's really no reason.
And it's a relic of bygone days, like the gold standard, right?
Right. It's one of those old things that, you know, used to help people. But it's probably more important today, you know, maybe more important than it's ever been before, because we have more stupid laws on the books than we've ever had. But there's a lot of history behind it. One of the first documented historical cases was William Penn around 1670. He faced a jury. He had angered the king because he had assembled a group of Quakers without permission, God forbid, but the jury refused to convict. They said, you know what, that's not a legitimate crime, not guilty. 1850s, the Fugitive Slave Act had made harboring a slave illegal, even in the northern states, but people did it anyway because that law is not legitimate. And again, juries refused to convict people for harboring fugitive slaves. They let their conscience be their guide and said, no, not going to send somebody to jail. I don't care if they did harbor a slave. Prohibition era, they refused to convict people for alcohol-related crimes. And that eventually was a big part of leading to the repeal of prohibition. Today, you know, you think of the drug laws as being the, you know, the biggest category of victimless crimes, and that's huge. We've got so many people in cages now for victimless crimes. It's insane. But in addition to drugs, we've got raw milk, or people that watered their lawn when they shouldn't, or people that didn't water their lawn when they should, or or carrying a firearm and across a state border when they didn't realize it was, you know, their rights no longer applied. We have so many ridiculous laws on the books that jury nullification is becoming more and more important today.
And I think it's just important. It's so important that people even hear the term, that there's even such a thing as that, because I think, you know, I always think of Bill on King of the Hill saying, well, I was on a jury three times and we did our duty all three times. We convicted. And that really is kind of the way people perceive their role on a jury, is they're kind of junior prosecutors for a day. It's like going on a field trip or something where they get to take part in this thing for a minute, and they don't see it as a chance to actually maybe spare someone, have mercy on someone, rather than going along with and playing a role, fitting into a role with the judge and the prosecutor. They can play an altogether separate role as a real check on what the government would have done to someone. I mean, you can read, as you mentioned all the time, the length of the sentences for the most meager of crimes ought to be enough to get just regular, decent people, if they got the idea that it's okay, this is your role, for them to say, you know what, I am not going to go along with this. Where, you know, before they might, because part of being a good person is going along with this. And the judge, he sure seemed to really expect me to convict here. And so, after all, everybody agreed. The guy seemed to have the drugs in his pocket or whatever it was. And so, you know, where's the argument? They got to have some kind of dissonance in their head, some voice speaking up saying, well, you know, they can't convict you for refusing to go along with this. It's not a crime to acquit, and you don't have to explain why you decided the evidence isn't good enough or anything like that. Just vote no, that's all. So for me, just, in fact, I even have a bumper sticker that says, you've just begun reading about jury nullification. And then they're supposed to go run off from there, but that's enough. I want them to just know the term, have heard the term once in their life before, for crying out loud.
You make excellent points. In fact, I had a friend recently on a jury, and he told me a woman actually said to him in the jury deliberations, she says, well, he wouldn't even be on trial if he wasn't guilty. People think that way. And, you know, we have a society where people are really conditioned to obey authority figures. And if you've been in a courtroom, you see immediately there's this guy in a special outfit. He's sitting at a desk that's a foot or two higher than everybody else. He's adorned with trappings, and there's flags, and there's a giant logo behind his head, and he's presiding over this room, and he gets a title of royalty, and everybody stands up when he comes in. And you know, it's like, wow, you know, who's in charge there? Well, they've structured all of that to make it look like that guy in the black dress is in charge. But the most powerful person in that room is the juror, and they don't have to take commands from anybody. And you're not supposed to check your conscience at the door. And that is basically the purpose of this campaign, is just to remind people, yeah, you're the one that's supposed to get between the government and the defendant and make sure this is fair. They often make it impossible for the jurors to even know what sentence the defendant is facing. So let's just say, you know, a person that might be facing 30 years in jail because they had drugs or ran a website or who knows what they did. But, you know, they say, well, gosh, if the jurors knew what we're going to do to this guy, they might not want to convict. Their conscience might wake up. So they forbid that. They'll forbid any kind of information that might get to the jury to be like, hey, this is actually a nice person, and he really didn't hurt anybody, and we want him to be in a cage for the rest of his life. And so that's why the work that we're doing is outside the courtroom, reaching out to the general public. We do it near courthouses, but we want everyone to get this idea that, look, you're going to get jury duty. You're going to get a summons at some point. It's completely normal to say, no, I don't want to go. Get me out of that. But it's a huge opportunity when you realize, first, how corrupt the U.S. justice system is, and two, what a huge opportunity you have to get somebody off the hook.
Right. All right. Well, hold it right there. When we get back, we'll have more with Jim Babb about jury nullification and this great project to do something about it. They're raising funds, and they've already got a bunch of ads out next to the courthouse in New York City there. This is, people always ask them, yeah, but what can we do? Hey, here's something you could do that could really save somebody's life. So get involved. We'll be right back. Hey, all, Scott here for Liberty.me, the brand new social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features nightly classes, guides, events, publishing, and so much more. Sign up now and you get the first 30 days free. And if you click through the link in the right margin at scotthorton.org or use the promo code Scott when you sign up, you'll save $5 per month for life. That's more than a third off the regular price. And hey, once you sign up, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. I'm on the phone with Jim Babb here. And I'm real sorry again for screwing up your name and identity and all that stuff earlier. Apologize about that. I screw up sometimes. This is a very important project here, juryrightsproject.com. And it says here, oh, I clicked the wrong tab here. It's the Jury Rights Activists Campaign to End Victimless Crimes Prosecutions in New York City in 2015. That's a great goal. It's a huge goal, but it's also a narrowly defined one. New York City's a big city, but still, it's a specific thing that you're trying to push, a specific campaign, and one that, you know, with any kind of success, will set a benchmark and a great example for what can be done in the future along these lines. And perfect timing, and I don't know, I guess it must be a coincidence, that we have the outrage over the Eric Garner grand jury no bill going on, and we have the police backlash where they're saying, well, we're now only going to arrest people when it's necessary instead of, like usual, when it's our fighting age male sweeps of black neighborhoods or whatever it is their usual thing. And so all reports I've seen from far away Austin, Texas, is that the Joker and the criminal element have not taken over. Muggings have not skyrocketed, et cetera, et cetera. Everything's fine. Everything's better now. Less cops, less enforcement of offenses against ordinances. And they're sticking only to busting people for actually committing crimes against other people, that kind of thing. Well, so what a great baton to pick up and run with right here. Here's how you can keep it this way. Here's how you can tell those cops, yeah, don't bother ever going back to those unnecessary arrests because we're just not going to give you convictions on them. We're done with this. Necessary arrests only. Thank you. I thought this was a free country, right?
Absolutely. I mean, this is it's just gone on for way too long. And this particular courthouse has a history of persecuting people. Professor Julian Heikland did pamphleting there. They were particularly cruel to him several years ago. He defied their orders to not pamphlet at this courthouse, and they hurt him physically. They put him in jail. They fabricated charges of jury tampering. They just went to war with Professor Heikland at this very courthouse, and he fought them, and he won, and he laid the groundwork for us to come in now and say, yeah, we do have a right to be here. You can't touch us. We're going to pamphlet. This is honest information. It's not jury tampering. We're going to be informing the public here.
And that was what he won in court, was that argument that this is simple First Amendment politics here?
Well, you know, what it really came down to was the law says you're not allowed to influence in writing a juror, you know, connected to a particular case. So because we're reaching out to the general public, this is not about a particular case. The court made that distinction and said, okay, that's fine. You can do that. You're not attempting to actually influence a particular case.
Well, that's a very important decision. I don't know how binding that is anywhere else, but it's a very important example because I've heard of that a lot of times where they try to call it jury tampering. They try to outlaw it somehow. They try to make up an excuse to prevent people from teaching each other about jury rights. I know that.
But, you know, in a way, the more grumpy they get about it, the better it is for our campaign. We did a similar campaign last year in Washington, D.C. And what made it really take off was the fact that there was a trial. I think it was a murder trial. And a prosecutor says to the judge, hey, judge, we need to make sure none of these jurors saw those billboards outside. And there was a Washington Post reporter in the audience. And the Washington Post reporter is like, billboards? What? What are you talking about? So then later that week, a photograph of our billboards appeared on the front page of the Washington Post with an article. So, you know, we kind of need them to, if they could be a little bit grumpy and help me generate some media attention, that'd be wonderful. The prosecutor's objections in D.C. ended up getting a nationwide NPR story and television and a just sort of triggered a media avalanche. So I'm looking for that here.
Right on. All right. So let's talk about hyperlinks. Let's talk about email lists and places where people can support and all the information you can possibly hit them with here.
Okay. juryrightsproject.com/NYC takes you right to this campaign. You can see pictures of the ads. There's a GoFundMe. There's a Bitcoin link. You can get involved. On the Jury Rights Project, there's also an educational course that you can sign up for lessons about jury rights. Fully Informed Jury Association is another great resource, fija.org. These guys have been at it for decades, educating the public about these rights. Two excellent sources people can go to.
Mm-hmm. And we still got time. So tell us some more stories about you know, really criminal prosecutions in the other sense, where people really don't deserve it and where where the jurors have stood up for the innocent and won. You got some of those?
Sure. You know, there's quite a few. There was a raw milk case where I think like 7 out of 8 charges were dropped up in Wisconsin recently. This heinous, somebody was actually providing a product for customers, but it was raw milk, so, you know, that was a big deal. I witnessed one myself.
Can
in
raw
New
milk
Jersey.
Get you high or something? What's the big deal with that?
Too dangerous. In New Jersey, there's a man, Ed Fortune, who goes by the name of NJ Weedman, was on trial for, they caught him with a pound of weed in his trunk. And he faced 2 charges. One was simple possession. The other was a distribution charge. And he made jury nullification a big part of his media outreach campaign, even though the judge forbid him from mentioning it. He went to court. We did pamphleting outside the courtroom. There was a good volunteer effort, and jury nullification really made the news big thanks to Ed's work.
That's what you need is rumors. You need rumors going around courthouses. Oh, did you hear this is the one that they're going to nullify?
That kind of thing, right? But so Ed actually says to the jury, he goes, you know, they call me NJ Weedman. Did you think I was going to have a joint? Of course, that's my personal stash. And he said, in fact, I'm eating pot brownies right now here in court.
the jury sided with him, huh?
Well, the first he got convicted for simple possession, which was a misdemeanor charge, which he was not concerned about. But it was the what was going to possibly put him in jail for years was the distribution charge. First trial was a hung jury. They retried him, came back not guilty on distribution, despite the fact that he freely admitted to having a pound of marijuana in his trunk.
That's great.
Which normally would be enough to get you sent away for several years. So was that jury nullification? I don't know. Did they just fail to make their case? I don't know. Ed seems to think it had a big role, and it's hard to deny it. There was another case in New Hampshire maybe 2 years ago where a man said, I use marijuana for religious purposes, and the jury said not guilty. So it's happening. It's happening all the time, and you're not necessarily going to hear about it because you don't have to tell the judge why you're saying not guilty. You just sit there and say not guilty. That's all you have to do. If you feel that law is unjust, you say not guilty. If you feel that law is being misapplied, then you just say not guilty. If you don't think the if you think the punishment's going to be too harsh for the crime, you say not guilty. You know, we're thinking, feeling human beings, and we need to use our conscience when we go into that courtroom, because the jury is the only one with the conscience in there. The prosecution doesn't. The judge doesn't. Everything is stacked against the defendant. Right. So
see, that's the thing, man, is everybody's imagining TV where so much fairness is built into the system. You know, in Law and Order, they're happy. This is always the start of Act Two of every episode of Law and Order is, oh, we had falsely concluded that it was the wrong guy. You're free to go. Now we think it's this guy. And they're perfectly happy to change their mind about who they're going at. You know, everything is based on getting it right, making sure we get it right. And, you know, I grew up watching Matlock, and it just seems like, well, of course, it has to be fair, or else they wouldn't be able to get away with making it not fair. It's only when you leave TV for a minute and you get to real courthouses that it's what you talk about. We're like, no, the jurors don't even get to know what sentence the guy's even facing. They don't know whether they're sending the guy to the penitentiary for 30 years or whether he's going to get a slap on a wrist or what. They don't really, you know, they're maybe made unaware of much of what an honest Matlockian defense might want to present to them, because it's already been excluded in hearings by the judge from being allowed, you know? So that's the thing. If people really have an idea how unfair it is and how simple it could be for them to inject a little fairness into the system, I think that'd be great. You see people sign up for jury duty on purpose instead of, avoiding it at all costs. Anyway, I'm sorry I talk too much for other people's interviews, but this great interview has been Jim Babb. He's at juryrightsproject.com, juryrightsproject.com/NYC. Thanks very much, Jim. Appreciate it.
Thank you.